about this. This is a session that he heard at our outreach conference this past year, and we've been kind of hinting at this, so we're changing gears. So what you have in the notebook is just something that you can use and read through, and because, like I said earlier, there are no fill-in-the-blanks, you get that too. But I want to speak on this particular topic, the things that I've learned from a challenging 2014. And let me say, to begin the session, these words, ministry, is about the grace of God. It is genuinely about grace. I've been very impressed that, meeting many of you, to find that many here in this auditorium have ministered in your place of service into the decades, some 30 years and more, if faithfully in your place of service. That does not come without a heaping helping measure of the grace of God. And I think it's accurate to say that anyone who is in this room who's been a pastor for more than 10 minutes has at some time in your pastorate decided to quit, or you've thought about quitting, or have become discouraged. And that is where grace really takes hold and needs to take hold of our hearts. I have been pastoring now. I'm in my 27th year of pastoring, having begun when I was 21 years old and have continuously pastored until the present moment. And there have been in that journey many occasions, difficult occasions, that really reach deep to the pastor's soul. That can be at times gut-wrenching occasions and problems and issues that really demand the grace of God and help. And last year, 2014, I think I can say, and I'm going to be brutally transparent with what I have to say this afternoon. Last year was by far the most difficult year that I've had in pastoral ministry. My church family probably would not know that unless they, some of them, sat in my session that I gave at our outreach conference. They probably would not have been aware of it. Even folks that are closer to me on a friend level, some of them may not fully have been aware of the difficult year that I faced. But I never faced a year in ministry where I felt more under the gun and more under pressure. So I'll get into some of the details of that in a moment. But look, if you will, at the introduction. Every pastor experiences challenging periods of ministry. Such periods can strengthen or destroy a pastor's tenure at his church. And I would say to the younger pastors in this room, when you face a problem, do not look at leaving as the first thought that crosses your mind. In fact, I would say more often than not, wisdom is to stick it out. That is not just true for the young, but it's true for the old. Whenever the pressure comes, wisdom is to stick it out. But these periods of pressure can strengthen or destroy a pastor's tenure at his church. While we cannot control all circumstances, we can always control our responses. What I just said there is a key, and I want everyone, if you underline stuff, you can underline that. I cannot control what the members of my church do. I can control how I respond. Everyone follow what I said? I cannot control what happens in the financial area of the church as far as the offerings coming in. I can control my response. Part of the frustration of ministry is that we try to control people. Now listen carefully. That is nearly impossible. And if their conformity to the Bible is based upon your manipulation or your ability to control, it is not real anyway. Because what our desire is that the Holy Spirit is doing a deeper work in their life to transform them into the image of Christ, not my ability to manipulate or to browbeat them into some kind of a conformity so that I can have full control. I have learned that it is frustrating to seek to control people, but I have also learned this: I can always control myself. That one statement is a key to finding peace. But let me give some details here. Here's what I learned through a challenging 2014. You say, "Preacher, what happened?" Last year, on the 1st of January, began with an early morning phone call. A family in our church called weeping and explained that in the early morning hours of January the 1st, they had lost their grandson in an automobile accident, of course, alcohol-related, on New Year's Eve. And the young man went into eternity. He would have been in his early 20s. He had a testimony, but we're just not sure. We'll just trust the Lord for all of those things and go from there. That began a series of funerals in the first 2 months of last year, pardon me, 2014. In the first 2 months of 2014, I did 8 funerals. 8. That's a lot of funerals. Honestly, you're feeling like a broken record. And because some of them were people that were very, very close, you're feeling kind of like a basket case and like you're kind of weeping. This is a lot of stress on a pastor. It almost made me think too much of my own mortality. I think it's good sometimes to think of your own mortality, but not in the terms that I was thinking of. I, you know, 8 funerals. I'm looking at caskets. I'm thinking, huh, that's a nice model. Maybe I should get that one. You know? And my mind, all these things are starting to play upon my mind. In addition to that, when you have this many people who are dying, and some of them younger people, okay, one man just a few years older than myself, some of them younger people, these are people for whom you've prayed in the hospital. So, Brother McMorris, I would go to the hospital during this time period, and there was someone who was ill, and because I was doing so many funerals, I got superstitious about going to the hospital. I sometimes referred to myself as the death angel. I kiddingly told the congregation, don't call on me to come to the hospital and pray, because if I do, you will die. The Grim Reaper has arrived, you know. And someone asked me a while back if I anoint people with oil and pray over them. Do you do that, Pastor McMorris? I'll do that if people ask me to. I've done it probably 24 times in my ministry, with only one exception. Every time I've ever done that, the person has died. With only one exception. The other exception was it was a mom who wanted to have children, and she has lots of kids now. But that was so don't ask me to do that. It's a death sentence. But anyway, I got to feeling like I was going to hospitals and praying, and my prayers weren't being answered, but these people were dying. I was burying people, and the pressure and stress of that played upon my mind and my own thinking, and everything was doom and gloom and funerals and graveyards and open caskets and closed caskets and funeral directors. That's a tremendous amount of pressure to that many funerals in two months. But then something else happened. There was a couple in our church who'd been there for decades. And he had served for almost 3 decades as a deacon. About a year and a half prior to this, I had to ask him to step away from that position because he had made some decisions for which I later found physical evidence. There's no question about my judgment in regard to this because I had physical evidence to demonstrate this, that this man had a problem that would remove him from being a deacon. I'm speaking very, very generally. There's not one pastor in this room that if confronted with the same physical evidence that I was given would have made any decision different from the decision that I was forced to make. It wasn't a decision that I wanted to make. It came as a real surprise because the individual had been someone that I had trusted, had served alongside with the entire time I was in the pastorate at that church. He was one of the men who had formed the committee that ultimately called me to that church. And so this happened a year and a half or so previous. Well, all of that would have been fine. The family stayed in church, except for this. That couple became extremely critical of everything that happened in the church. Everything. Now, prior to that, he'd never criticized anything, really. Oh, there were little things we had to fix, and he had ideas and things, nothing negative. But after he was no longer in deacon leadership, he took it upon himself to become the critic of everything. Let me ask a question. I've got some teenagers over here. Who is the coolest teenager in this group? Who? It's one of these two blonde-headed guys. Right there? Okay, you with the tie. Well, you both have ties. You right here on the court. Come up here just a second. Because you've been voted the coolest teenager. I want to demonstrate something. Now, by the way, what's your name? Jonah. Come right over here, Jonah. Can I tell you something, Jonah? If you don't get what I'm about to do, you lose cool points. Okay, just so you know that, okay? Now, we're going to shake hands, but we're not just going to shake hands. Okay, watch what we're going to do. Very good, man. Give him a round of applause. Do you see that? Where I come from, they call that ghetto born, ghetto bred, and when he dies, he'll be ghetto dead. But it's the brother handshake, okay? Did everybody see that? Now, that's what young people do, and some of us older people do. Nothing wrong with that, right? This man and his wife saw one of my staff members shaking hands with a member of the congregation that way and called a meeting in my office. I'm not kidding. You can't make stuff like this up. And said, "Pastor Monty, we have witnessed the secret handshake." I said, What are you talking about? And he kind of described it, and it was that handshake. And he said, "A member of your staff had that secret handshake with another male member of the church, and we saw it in the lobby." And I said, "And?" And his response was, "That shows too much familiarity. The staff should not be that familiar with the members of the church." Do you see how nitpicky this is? Incredibly nitpicky. We have one of the most conservative hymn books in fundamentalism. We have the Bible Truth Hymn Book. Not only conservative, but slightly redneck. Okay, any guy by the name of Byron Fox has got to be a redneck, and he put it together. And yet this lady said, "That hymn book has 8 songs in it that are an abomination to the Lord." What? And the nitpicking went on and on and on. Well, let me be honest with you. I'm not upset if someone has an honest criticism and they come to me about it. I'm fine with that. As a pastor, I want to wade through what's important and what is not, stuff like the secret handshake. And I work through all those things because I am a pastor and I love my people. But where I have an issue, and I think every pastor in this room would agree with me, where I have an issue is when, rather than coming to me about this, you know where I'm going, don't you, gentlemen? I can see you've been there, right? They decide to go to other people in the congregation and then begin an undermining, a systematic undermining of the ministry. After all of those funerals, I start to sense. How many pastors, raise your hand if you've ever sensed trouble afoot? Have you ever? Well, we have a, it's like psycho. We have this ability to sniff it out. And I'm sensing some things. Then I went on a little canoe trip with a member of the church. It's kind of an annual event. He and I go. And it was funny how he started saying the same things to me in the same phraseology that these people were. So immediately I asked, I said, "Have you been talking to so-and-so?" "Well, actually, yeah, so-and-so approached me, blah, 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 blah." This was on a Saturday. That really bothered me. Because this man who'd for almost 30 years been a deacon knows better than to do something like that. And so I get to the church and I'm fairly bothered on Sunday morning. I see a man that I think would be a potential victim of one of these people. Do you know what I'm talking about, preachers? You know who they're going to go after. Okay, and so I asked him, I said, this guy called him my name, I said, "Hey, did so-and-so approach you recently and list this as issues in the church?" He said, "Yeah." He said, "Preacher, I was going to talk to you about that." As a matter of fact, he did. After Sunday school, by the way, can I share something with you? I'm a human being. By now, I am doing a slow burn. Okay, I'm making it through Sunday school, but just barely. I am wound up. Right after Sunday school, I thought, I'm going to ask Brother So-and-so. So I went over to Brother So-and-so and said, "Hey, did so-and-so talk to you about this?" And he said, "Yeah, you know, as a matter of fact, you know, he's got a real problem with that. I was going to talk to you about this, and this." Oh, so now we have a coalition being formed. I've gone through 2 months of 8 funerals and some rather very personally depressing times because of the funerals and because of the other things. And now I feel that someone who was on my side has turned against me to the point of undermining the ministry. Now, here's a part of transparency that I'm going to share with you that a lot of pastors would not say publicly. Okay, but I'm not out to say it. I don't know where you are in this. I personally struggle with depression. There. Said it. I personally don't take medication for it, but I fight it. Do you know nobody knows except my wife and maybe a couple close friends when I'm going through that? Can anyone name a famous preacher that went through that? Spurgeon, Charles Haddon Spurgeon. Brand new book out, by the way, called Spurgeon's Sorrows. What a great book to give to someone who struggles with depression. It catalogs all of Spurgeon's references in his sermons to depression and how advanced in his thinking he was. A young doctoral student, some school, put this together. It's an excellent little book called Spurgeon's Sorrows. Very, very good book. And so I was dealing with that at the time. And then all of a sudden, I feel like there's a rift developing in the church. You say, Pastor Bonnie, what did you do? It was Sunday, June 8th, a day which at our church will live in infamy. I had a really nice sermon that I was going to preach, and I kept the text. But let me be honest, this is one time that I didn't really preach the text. I read it, and then I unleashed the beast. You ever heard the song, Who Let the Dogs Out? People were wondering. I was frankly more angry in the pulpit than I've ever been in my life. And I decided, you know, I could have used a scalpel to excise the problem, but I decided to choose an axe. And I dealt with the problem. By the way, before I preached the message, I cornered the guilty party in the lobby and I said, you are in my office after the morning service, no excuses. I blew up in the morning service to the extent that it scared the congregation. My wife didn't even know what was happening. She didn't know what I was preaching on. She had no idea about any of this. She was, as all good pastors' wives do, she was skipping church. She was in the nursery or something like that. And so after church, all these people are telling her how much they love her, how much they're praying for her, and all of these things. She doesn't have a clue what just went on. My young married group said later that they're going to print T-shirts that say, I survived Sunday, June 8th at Faith Baptist Church, okay? I mean, has anyone ever been here with this kind of thing? I don't know. One lady said, she said, you probably solved more problems in that one sermon than you were aware of existed. Everybody felt guilty. They were coming to me saying, who is I? There was a cookout that afternoon with the young marrieds. When I got out of the car, they had invited me to their cookout. When I got out of the car to attend their cookout, they all got really quiet and sheepish. They're all kind of looking at the ground, and here comes the preacher. And finally, I said, all of you, stop it! It was none of you. It didn't involve any of you. Just get over it. And they all started laughing. And then one lady, her eyes got real big. She said, oh, Pastor Monty, I was so scared. I've never been so scared in my life. This is supposed to be church, not a haunted house. What did I learn from that experience? Can I share some things quickly, what I learned from that? I learned a lot of things. Look at this. Number one, close friends are vital to long-term ministry. Do you know what you need? You need to have a pastor friend that you can talk to and be transparent with. And I'm not talking about somebody that you need to be fake with or look better or holier than thou or compare your list of standards to their list of standards. I'm talking about someone with whom you can be completely transparent, who is discreet, who you can trust. I value the people in my life that I can express myself to without ever worrying that they're going to pass judgment on me. By the way, Baptist fundamental preachers, why don't you be that person for someone else? There's a huge problem. If we as preachers don't have close relationships, there's a huge problem. It's usually our fault because we've built up artificial walls or we have set certain standards and say if they don't reach this standard, we won't affiliate with them. The truth of the matter is every one of us falls short of God's standard and every one of us needs someone to whom we can turn. I learned the value of close friendships, of loyalty, of having accountability. I learned that through this. Point B, because of the nature of pastoral ministry, and you have this, I think, on your outline, pastors should seek such friendships with other pastors, not within the church, okay? You understand that. Now, I'm very relational with my people and probably closer to them than the average pastor is, but sometimes if you have just one close friendship in the church, it causes jealousy, it causes other things of that nature. How do you build a close friendship? Well, they're not instant. They develop over time and share experience. Close friendships are like cultivating a garden. They take time to bear fruit. I would note this, beware of friendship with a man who has no noticeable close relationships. There's a reason nobody hangs out with him. Now look this way. Look this way. Boy, this is rich. If a man has no friends, there's a reason. Okay, if someone comes to your church, and you talk to them about what's your church history? Well, we used to, back in 1970, from 72 to 74, we were members of this church. And then from 74 on to about 1980s, we were members of this church. And if they can take you this whole string of broken relationships, and then when they get up to the present moment, and we're going to leave Brother So-and-so's church, and we're going to come to yours, because you have all the answers. You, my friend, are the next victim. People that have no close friendships in life are fundamentally troubled people. Beware of that. But you as a pastor need to have that kind of transparent relationship with someone. It's very, very important. I inserted this thought, fundamentalist politics and friendship do not mix. Avoid close relationships with men who have a fundamentalist political agenda. Look this way, everyone. Everybody is sick of that, myself included. Drop the agenda and be real. Can I tell you what the young men, why, Pastor Monty, all these young men are leaving the fundamental movement? Do you know why? They are sick to death of the politics. Okay? But Pastor, I want to be president of the local ministerial fellowship. Why would you want to be that? That sounds like an incredible headache to me. Why don't you just love people and be their friend? When you set aside politics and embrace a relational philosophy, that's when it becomes real. If four pastors can't get together without electing a president, vice president, secretary, and treasurer to oversee the luncheon, okay, we have a problem. But if people can get together on a real human level, those friendships provide the help that we need. I experienced that through a difficult time. Number two, though, quickly, I need to hurry on. There's a lot of good things. Go with your gut. Go with your gut. Preacher, what do you mean? Spirit-led intuition, note those words, spirit-led intuition should get our attention. If you have an uneasy feeling about a situation, do not silence that feeling. Act on it. Preachers, write this down. Here's a good recommendation for you. A book called Firestorm, The Anatomy of a Church Split. I don't know the author's name, but that's the title of the book, Firestorm, The Anatomy of a Church Split. A guy did a doctoral thesis. Why do churches split? What causes the problem? Why do, and he did all kinds of churches, Protestant and Baptist and Evangelical, all kinds of things. Why do these churches split? Get the book and read it, but the number one point he made was this, that pastors did not act on a problem when it was small, because they thought it would correct itself. Most of us in this room do not like personal confrontation. I am one of those. But I've learned something. If I have a gut instinct that something isn't right or isn't the way it ought to be, I ought to act on that spirit-led gut instinct. Way back when the people I'm talking about in the message, way back when I had to remove this man and ask him not to run for deacon again, before that ever happened, there was a series of events that took place. And Brother McMorris, I had a gut instinct at that point that I needed to intervene in something. But I trusted this individual, and so against my gut instinct, I ignored certain things that I observed. That was not good. I've learned something. The moment I'm uncomfortable, I gently, kindly, and clearly confront a situation. Do that a few times in your church, and it'll amaze you how few situations arise because all of a sudden people get the impression, oh, the preacher is going to take care of these things. He will act on it. Act quickly and calmly. Do not allow problems to fester. Do not try to silence your inner suspicions. While preaching can correct some church issues, it is no substitute for personal confrontation. Do not delay clear, calm confrontation. Don't delay. If there's something that troubles you, take the lead and confront and make sure things are okay. Do not overly trust the motives of quote-unquote good people. Ronald Reagan said, trust but verify. Remember, the best of men have a dark side. This is very, very good advice. And you want to help things. You said, Pastor Monty, you took care of the problem on June 8th. You blew it up! Yeah, I did. But you know what? There would not have been a June 8th had there 3 years earlier I acted on a definite gut instinct. You know what I chose to do? To silence that. And that's what built the problem that led to this man's being forced not to be a deacon, and then I think ultimately to his departure from a church that he had served for decades, because I failed to simply say, you will not do this, 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 and this any longer, when it was in my power to do so. Okay, so act upon a gut instinct when you have those kind of things. Don't silence them. Number three, do not expect antagonistic church members to give you the level of grace you have given to them. While the church should minister grace to its pastor, few members understand the pressure of ministry. Many have high expectations of your perfection, and they tend to deal less graciously with your shortcomings. People in conflict almost always dismiss biblical relationship principles such as forgiveness and reconciliation. You just need to realize that. Pastor Ronnie, we're fundamental Baptists, and we believe the Bible. Yes, you do, until you have a problem with somebody. And then the first thing that is jettisoned is the Word of God in relationship issues. And I'll be frank, that plagues Christianity. Because if you look at your New Testament, you will find more commands relating to how we relate to one another than almost any other subject. But the moment our feathers get ruffled or the fur is rubbed the wrong way, the moment that happens, we find every excuse in the world not to do what the Bible says. And our churches are filled with people who have non-forgiveness. They're unforgiving. Our churches are filled with people who refuse reconciliation. They won't do it. And Pastor Monty, you know, I know Jesus taught forgiveness, but if you had so-and-so did to you, you wouldn't forgive him either. I hear that time and time again. And a wise pastor understands that there are some people that the moment their feathers are ruffled, they will never follow a biblical precept. Though in other things, they would never smoke. They would never chew. They would never run with those who do, but they'd think nothing about splitting a church. I'd 10,000 times rather have cigarette-smoking men than church-splitting men. I don't think ladies should smoke. I think it's unladylike. I have standards. I'd rather have a smoking preacher like Brother McMorris than to, just kidding. Do you see what I'm saying? It's a point of attitude, Someone says, I've got this very high standard, but I'll blow up the Lord's church. Very dangerous thing. Look at number four quickly. For your sake, become a student of your moods. Emotional and mental state and personality traits influence your responses. To respond properly to given situations, you must accurately assess your feelings. Gentlemen, here's what I learned. If I'm not feeling stable, I shouldn't be preaching. Okay? That's just a thought. I mean, one time before all this blew up, earlier that fall, and when I say blew up, by the way, we lost one couple over the whole thing. Okay? No church split or anything occurred. As my pastor, R.V. Clearwater, used to say, it was a splinter, not a split. He had some doozy splits, though. Prior to this ever happening, I was at a church on a Wednesday night. I was talking to somebody in the aisle. This man came up to me frothing at the mouth about something, and he interrupted me when I was talking to some people 4 minutes until the service was to start. He said, Pastor, you need to come and you need to look out this window, and you need to look out this window now. Okay, so I walked over to the lobby. I looked out the window. He said, what do you see? I said, buses. That's all that was there. He runs up to the window. Oh, they're gone. They're gone. He was accusing someone of talking to another someone of the opposite sex. When he made that clear to me, I said, were they by themselves or in a group? They were in a group. What? They're in a group. But see, the lady he was all worked up about was someone that he had mental designs upon. Let me just put it that way. We're down to a minute and a half before church starts. Has this ever happened to any of you? Thank you. I'm so glad. I love to see this. It's so normal. So, preacher, what do? I was furious. I was furious. I got on the platform. I leaned over to the assistant. I said, if I walk off this platform, tell the folks I'm not feeling good, and you just take the service. He would be ready to do that. But instead, I decided, no, I've got to get this emotion out. Anyone ever been there? So I decided, Brother Rader, you'd love this. This would work for you. I decided to be as goofy as I could possibly be on the platform, to laugh, to joke, to do crazy stuff, to lead songs, get everybody worked up. And I did that, and all the emotion went away. But I judged myself that the way I was feeling, I almost had to walk off the platform. Okay, that's just being honest. Because we don't want to be damaging. We don't want to. Be a student of your moods. Be thinking about those things, how you feel. Understand those things. Depression, excessive anger, hurt, and betrayal. The next one, real important as we wind down. Nip cynicism in the bud. What is cynicism? Cynicism is the poison of the pastor's soul. No man who entertains cynicism remains long in ministry. Look this way. Pastors get cynical when someone makes a decision for Christ, and in the back of their mind they're saying, yeah, we'll see how long that lasts. Pastors get cynical when someone comes to visit the church, and in the back of their mind they're saying, yeah, they might be visiting now, but they won't stay with us very long. Pastors are cynical when they look at a young person who has strayed, and rather than love that young person and work with them through their issue, they write them off as a self-defense mechanism. Pastors are cynical when they leave church immediately after the service is done, only perfunctorily speaking to individuals, shaking a couple hands, and can hardly wait to get away from the people of God. These are marks of cynicism. Pastors become cynical when all they are doing is collecting a paycheck and they view their ministry as the way they make money rather than a divine calling. And I think I'm right to say, we'll not have a hand raise here, but I think I'm right to say that some of the characteristics I've just given, we have each experienced at one time or another. And we become cynical because we get disappointed. And when people disappoint us in areas of deepest consequence, we become cynical. We think all are going to be like that. No one understands. And it develops a very negative pattern of thinking. What do I need to do? I need to recognize that negative thinking for what it is. You keep that up and you won't be in the ministry long. Why is it that some pastors quit at their church just before God's about to do something? I'll tell you, they think negative, negative, negative. Everything that happens is bad. There's no hope. These people are no good. And that goes round and round and round in their head. It is a pattern that develops, and if we don't recognize it, it takes us over. What do? We pray about this thing. Give it to the Lord. There's a little trick I learned. You call this a gimmick if you want to, but it works for me. We have a Methodist church next to our house. Back behind the Methodist church, they have a little fire pit with a seating around it, you know, and things like that. And whenever I have a situation, Brother McMorris, that I've done everything I can do, okay, everything I can do. I think of everything I can do. I'm not being lazy about it. I've addressed the issue, but I just can't do anything more. But in the back of my mind, I can't shake the thinking. You ever been there? You've done everything you can do, but you can't get it off of your mind. You say, what do you do? The Bible says, cast thy burden upon the Lord. The Bible says, give him all of your care. So I go to that little Methodist church fire pit. It's good that it's a Methodist church. I've left more garbage at the Methodist church. I go to that little Methodist church fire pit, and I sit down. I say, Lord, I say, here's the problem. And I just spell it all out. And then I say, Lord, if there's something else I can do, speak to my heart about what else I can do. And I might even wait. If nothing comes to mind, I say, Lord, here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to cast my burden on you. I'm going to trust you to deal with this. If you bring something additional to mind that I can do to handle this, then, Lord, I'll do that. But I'm leaving it here, and here's the key. I say, Lord, when I get up from this spot, I'm walking away from this, and I'm leaving it there. That's healthy. That's healthy. Well, Pastor Monty, won't it come back to your brain? The minute it comes back to your brain, all of a sudden say, nope, I left that there. The Methodists are in charge of that. I left it there. That's how to nip cynicism. Learn, gentlemen, to dismiss criticism quickly. Entertaining criticism leads to cynicism. Someone defined criticism as death by 10,000 cuts. Isn't that true? You can't control the critics, but you can stop the bleeding by not meditating on it. Hey, ladies, you'll get this. Ladies, you all dress so pretty and everyone looks so nice, you know. Have you ever, though, worn a beautiful brand new dress and you wore it to church and five people said, wow, it's a beautiful new dress. You look so nice in that dress. It's just lovely. And one person walks up to you and says something like this. Wow, that's a nice dress. Do they make it in your size? That's awful, isn't it? And that one person, you could have five people say how much they liked it. And the one person, you're just like eaten up by that. And so Pastor McMorris, you get 10 cards. God bless you. We love you, Pastor. You're just the best pastor we've ever had. And then you get one little note of criticism. And what eats you alive? What keeps you up at night? Here's the thing. Dismiss those more quickly, okay? Now, if someone has a legitimate gripe, you need to hear it and correct it. A good pastor will do that. A good shepherd will do that. I learn a lot of things about corrective things from the people. So don't, but those things that are just little picky things, don't let them eat you alive. You can't afford that. It ruins it for the rest of the people. Rehearse the positives in your situation over and over again. Well, Pastor, you know, I'm in this really rough spot, and this is a hard place, and nobody wants to hear the gospel. It's burned over for the gospel, or they're all Lutheran or Catholic, or whatever the thing may be. Stop a minute. Do you know where we live? We live in the United States of America. Anyone ever travel overseas? There's not one country in this world that I'd rather live in except the Caribbean. Just kidding. There's really not one country I'd rather live in. Do you know how good we have it? We traveled to Romania and visited gypsies in Romania. They live in something that is less than my, what we call a Hoosier barn, little backyard barn for garden shed for storage. I'd rather live in my garden shed than the houses those people live in. See, all of our problems are first world problems. They're not third world problems. But the truth is, we become so focused on those things, the negativity comes into our mind so quickly, all of a sudden we forget about all the pluses of life. You say, Pastor Monty, we've had the hardest winter. Yes, but look at outside now. Look at the positives of life. And then lastly, let me say this, and this I think is important. Accept the level of relationship with others that others want to maintain with you. Okay, this is an important point. Here's something, pastors. When you have a vision bigger for someone else than they have for themselves, you've lined yourself up for disappointment. When you inspire someone else to have a greater vision for himself, you've lined yourself up for possibility of victory. Does everyone see the difference? If I have a vision for someone that's bigger, if I have a desire for relationship that is deeper than the other guy, I've kind of lined myself up for disappointment. Illustration, I'm a very relational person. When I make a friend, I want that person to be my friend for the rest of my life. I want them to be loyal. I want them to be kind. I want them to be considerate. I want them to be someone in whom I confide, and I want them to be someone who gives me money. No, just kidding. I want a relationship to last forever. There are a lot of people who are non-relational who don't care about that, okay? And I think they're weirdos. And they move in and out of a person's life. You know what I'm talking about? There are people who are just passing through your life. And when you're a relational like me, you give that person your heart. And then all of a sudden, they like you. And you say, man, I'm really close to so-and-so. Yeah, relationship really developing. Boy, so-and-so is going to be a good friend. They're going to be a good church member. Man, we're really working together. And then all of a sudden, the jaybird turns his back and heads down the road to some church somewhere else. And they act as if they never knew you before. To a relation, not to people who are like that, antisocial weirdos, that's just their personality. But to relational people, you really get hurt by that, okay? And I, as a pastor, would say that I've really in the past been hurt by that. Preacher, what do you do? When people leave the story that is your life, don't obsess over it. They aren't. They washed their hands of you. They shook off the dust of their feet, and they walked out the door. And if you spend your life obsessing over that, you'll miss the opportunity you have to minister to those that God has given you who want something. Here's what I'm saying. In a tough time, look at what God's given you. Assess it over and over again. Do everything you can. And then learn to simply rest and rely on Him. Be a student of yourself. Understand your responses. Be careful. If there's a time when you just shouldn't be up there in front of the people, don't be. It might do more harm than good. And learn to turn it over to God. I'll close with this thought. What's really neat about Northern Michigan is the number of pastors in this room who have been doing this for decades. Decades. And you've gone through some real heartache. But you've trusted God. There's something solid about that. I would say keep it up. And I would also say I have much to learn from you. Father, thank you for